A listener note, this story contains adult content and language.
As the reality of what had been done to Mary Eford began to sink in, Robert Henderson started asking questions about Dr. Christopher Dunch.
I said anyone with a minimal amount of training would have hesitated to go forward with the next step when they realized that they were lost. Or could this possibly be an imposter impersonating a physician and a surgeon?
He began to investigate.
I got a copy of his picture that he had submitted with his application. And then I got a hold of Dr. Kevin Foley, who was his fellowship mentor in Memphis, Tennessee.
And did you talk to Dr. Foley?
I did. I spoke to Dr. Foley. He essentially told me that during his mentorship, he hadn't noticed any issues with Dr. Dunch.
Henderson couldn't understand how a surgeon this incompetent could have ever made it out of residency. He decided to double check.
I said, can I just send you a picture from his application to find out if we're dealing with the same person and make sure we don't have an imposter circulating in the community here? And so he said, sure. So I sent him a picture.
Within minutes, Foley confirmed that the doctor in the photo was, in fact, Christopher Dunch. He had graduated from medical school. He had completed a residency in neurosurgery. He was a bona fide MD and a PhD.
It's an unbelievable story. Hard for me to fathom that that's the guy that used to be my close friend and used to hang out and was my roommate.
Cooper Bailey was Chris's roommate in Memphis when he was finishing college. Cooper knew Chris Dunch as a smart, driven, if somewhat absent-minded, friend.
You know, he was athletic, you know, in great shape, good-looking guy, you know, all the girls liked him, you know, he was an excellent student. I mean, he was just, I mean, you know, you think of your all-American guy, man, that's what he was.
If Dr. Henderson had trouble believing Dunch was a real doctor, the people who'd known him a long time, people like Cooper Bailey, would later have trouble believing the doctor he became.
The news media has made, they make him out like he is, Dr. Death. You know what? That is what he is. He's become that. But that's not, I don't know Dr. Death. You know, I know Chris Dunch.
From the writer and director of Netflix's Evil Genius comes your next true crime obsession, Bad, Bad Thing, a podcast about an affair, a wife's plea for honesty, and the killing of two people. This crime made international news, but now Bad, Bad Thing takes you behind the headlines to actually hear for the first time secret recordings the wife, Jenaire Girardeau, left behind. Tell everyone the truth behind all of this, she begs. I am not a scorned wife who went off the deep end. With insight from esteemed clinical psychologist Dr. Ramani Durvasula, Bad Bad Thing unravels what happens when powerful emotions like desire, betrayal, and revenge take root in someone's soul. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe and download Bad Bad Thing now at Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery, I'm Laura Beal, and this is Dr. Death. This is Episode 2, Chris and Jerry. The patients who put their trust in Christopher Dunch had good reason to. He made it to the operating rooms of Dallas with impeccable credentials. He graduated from one of the top spinal programs in the country, and he'd worked hard to get there. He was born in Montana, but eventually his family settled in Memphis, Tennessee when he was in junior high. The four Dunch children enrolled in Evangelical Christian School in the Memphis suburb of Cordova. A lot of kids there were the children of doctors, lawyers, and CEOs. Chris's dad was a physical therapist, and his mom stayed home. His family wasn't as well off as many of his classmates. But that didn't seem to matter, especially because Chris was a football star. He played nose guard and linebacker for the ECS Eagles.
As I said, Chris was very determined and a good-looking guy.
Michael Francis was also on the team and was best friends with Chris's younger brother. He remembers Chris as a volatile teenager, something that could sometimes get him into trouble.
I remember we were playing the first-ranked team in the state, Brentwood Academy. It was our first game of the year, and, I mean, we were supposed to, you know, be one of the best in the states, one of the best in the state. And, I mean, it was a Friday afternoon.
They were at Chris's house getting ready for the game later that day.
Chris was so, I guess, inked up, wrapped up, whatever you want to call it, that, I mean, he was just going crazy, yelling, and, I mean, not really at anybody, just more, I guess, to stay pumped. But anyway, his dad came in, and, I mean, his dad was a bigger guy than we were, and Chris at that point, ex-football player, missionary, and, I mean, he didn't take anything from anybody, definitely not any lip. I remember Chris was just running his mouth, and his dad, as I said, picked him up by his hair, and he came about 3 inches off the ground.
Chris's dad could be strict, but he was, by all accounts, devoted to his family. Another teammate who didn't want to be named remembers Chris.
You know, he wasn't much of a fighter, just more of a competitor. And I don't recall him ever getting really angry and ferocious about anything. Just kind of, you know, had his goal, his you know, sight on a goal and, you know, whatever it took to get there.
That was one thing I heard time and time again. Christopher Dunch was driven. When he set his mind to do something, he wanted to do it better than anyone. Whether it was drinking.
Chris would, you know, be, you know, the kind that would want to funnel a beer quicker than, you know, anyone. And
or wrestling.
It just, when he gets something in his mind, it just was like nonstop. You know, I'm going to beat Cooper in wrestling.
Or weightlifting.
I'm going to beat Cooper in weightlifting.
And he wouldn't back down. After high school, Dunch went on to Mississippi on a football scholarship at a small college in Jackson. It was a respectable achievement, but it wasn't enough for him. He soon had his sights set on a bigger goal, the Division I Colorado State Rams. He wasn't recruited, but tried out and made the team as one of only a small number of walk-on players. It was with the Rams that he met Chris Dozois.
Chris was also a linebacker, and both of us were on the bottom rung of the team. We were the new guys, and so we had that piece. And then we kind of found a kinship in, we both kind of subscribed to the Rocky Balboa school of how you prepare to take on the season. And so we started working out together, and that's kind of when I first was introduced to his work ethic. I mean, Rocky IV is nothing but a workout montage, but the whole thing was about the guy that puts in the hard work can overcome the odds, and that the harder you worked and if you made those sacrifices, then you could make things happen. It was actually inspirational for me because in my mind, I thought I was the hardest working guy on the team, and to discover that there was a whole nother level was actually inspiring because I thought, wow, I mean, what's going to happen if I go to the level that Chris is working at?
Chris wasn't a gifted athlete, but he was determined to Rocky his way to football glory.
So it wasn't just that he wanted to be a linebacker. He wanted to be the linebacker. I remember in one practice we were doing these drills, and he was just really struggling to get it. So he would go through, and he would screw up the drill, and he'd go, Coach, let me try it again. And he'd go through, and he'd screw it up, and he'd be, Coach, I promise I can get this. Let me do it again. He'd go through. He'd screw it up again. And at this point, everyone else is like, dude, move on. Like, let's stop.
But Chris wouldn't stop.
So after practice, he'd go grab the coach and go, hey, will you come back over with me? I think I know how to do this drill. And he'd sit and he'd do the drill. And a coach would sit there and he'd continue to do this drill where everyone else is like, hey, man, you got practice tomorrow. This isn't worth worrying about. And then after practice, he'd come to me and say, hey, what are you seeing? What am I not getting in that drill? I'd explain to him, I'm like, hey, this is how this drill works. And then he'd have me practice with him. And then the next day he'd come back and go, hey, coach, if you don't mind, could we do this drill again? And then they'd do the drill again. And you know, you could see, okay, he's getting a little better at the drill. And then weeks later, the drill would come up again and you'd see, oh, he can almost do the drill now.
That was Chris. He wouldn't quit, even if it was obvious to everyone else that he really wasn't getting anywhere. Both guys got summer jobs together working concert security at Red Rocks Amphitheater. One afternoon, Dench called Dozois about a ride to work that night. They started talking about how to defuse the inevitable fights among drunk, unruly fans. Dench bragged that he'd be good at it because he was a skilled wrestler.
I made a joke. I'm like, dude, you're a terrible wrestler. And he hung up the phone on me, and I thought, what a weirdo.
As Dozois tells it, the next thing he knows, Chris is at his front door in a t-shirt and shorts.
And he's like, all right, come out in the front yard. We're wrestling. And I'm like, are you serious? And I'm like, you drove all the way over here from your house to wrestle. And he's like, yeah, you don't think I'm a good wrestler, so we're going to wrestle.
And right there in the front yard, they started to wrestle.
So I wrestled him. He's a horrible wrestler. I pinned him very quickly, and he immediately got up and was like, okay, I think I slipped. We got to do it again. So again, I pin him, and now all my brothers are teasing him, going, dude, you are a horrid wrestler. And so he goes walking off and goes back to his car. And so we all go back in the house, and then like 10 minutes later, he comes walking back up. I hear another knock on the door, and there he is again. And he's like, okay, you got to let me try again. I think I figured out what I was doing wrong.
In 1991, after only a year in Colorado, he transferred again, this time to Memphis State. He longed for the familiarity of home. But all his transfers had unintended consequences. He was no longer eligible to play football. The game he'd worked so hard at was over. He called Dozois about it.
I could tell he had been crying. He was having a really hard time talking. He kept having to pause. And I realized how much it meant to him.
Meanwhile, Dench's return to Tennessee from Colorado meant he reconnected with some old friends. Cooper Bailey was having a drink at a Memphis bar one day when he saw Chris for the first time in years.
I ran into him there. And we began, and I was like, what are you doing? So he had kind of told me.
Dench and Bailey ended up becoming roommates for a time in college. They rented a house with a couple of other guys near the University of Memphis. Bailey remembers Dench as a decent roommate, but with an unfortunate habit.
Young guys, what do? If we a house full of guys and we're all going to go out, we usually have a few drinks beforehand. So we would all be having a few drinks beforehand. And we'd, you know, be getting ready, and then we would all get ready. And Chris would start running around the house. Where are my keys? Who's hid my keys? Where are my keys?
Bailey says this happened so often, it became a running joke.
You know, 20 minutes later, we like, what are you doing? Come on, man, let's go. He's like, y'all have hid my keys? I'm like, no, we haven't, man. Look, we're not waiting any longer. And we would all get up to go walk out the door, and we'd open the door, and there in the door is what? Is his keys. And he did that all the time. It got to where the point, Chris, just check the door. Chris, just check the door. I'm like, man. So it just things like that. And we would make the joke when he'd talk about being, man, I'm going to cut people's heads and I'm going to work on them. I'm like, Chris, if I'm ever in the hospital, we would just make jokes. You're never working on us. And he's like, why? Why, man? You know how smart I am. I'm like, because you're probably the kind of guy that's going to end up sewing up. You'll end up sewing something up inside, you know, my head.
And there was another high school friendship Dench renewed when he came back to Memphis, Jerry Summers.
I've known Jerry longer than I've known Chris. They went to the same high school, played on the same sports team, so they had that connection that I didn't have with them. But I was friends with Jerry just as much, say maybe more, so.
Like Cooper Bailey, Chris and Jerry had met on the football field in high school. Jerry graduated from Evangelical Christian School the same year as Chris. He was a big guy who could fill a room. He was 6'4", with a deep voice and a hearty laugh.
Jerry's just one of those kind of, has a gregarious personality, and, you know, he's a very likable guy. He was an excellent athlete as a young guy.
And he was loyal. One time during his sophomore year, Chris was fighting with another boy and losing badly, until finally Jerry couldn't stand it anymore. He jumped in to defend his friend. With college and football behind him, Dunch poured himself into a new passion, medical school. In 1995, he started at the University of Tennessee. By then, Christo's wall had fallen out of touch with Dunch, but heard from Dunch's brother about what he was up to.
I remember him telling me, oh, Chris is going to be a neurosurgeon. He wants to be a brain surgeon. I'm like, of course he wants to be a brain surgeon, just like he wants to be the linebacker.
At the University of Tennessee, Chris became a rising star as a neurosurgery resident. The laboratory where he worked studied stem cells that might contribute to malignant brain tumors. But Chris thought the stem cells in his lab might be repurposed for another use. They could revitalize failing discs for people suffering back pain. He filed patents for this new disc stem cell technology with two other scientists from the lab. He raised money from investors and founded a company with a few of his supervisors, all while still getting his surgical training. While Chris was during his neurosurgery residency, he and Jerry Summers were hanging out almost every day. Their good friend Jennifer Miller remembers they'd stop by Chris's house for drinks all the time. She remembers one day.
Chris had his white coat on, his doctor's coat, and it said, Christopher Dunch, PhD, MD. And I thought, oh my gosh, this guy is more intelligent than I thought he was.
While Chris was preoccupied with his job at the lab, Jerry's job was to handle Chris. Chris had a terrible sense of direction. He was always getting lost. He couldn't balance a checkbook.
Jerry was just, they had been friends for so long. Jerry just did whatever Chris needed.
Did Jerry have his own job and he was helping Chris on the side?
No. At that time, Chris needed him just to work for him.
As Chris finished his residency, he started looking for a job. A medical practice in Dallas contacted his supervisors at the University of Tennessee to verify that Chris really was as good as his resume made him seem. They were told that he was one of the best and smartest neurosurgeons they'd ever trained. On a recommendation form, one of his supervisors wrote, Chris is extremely bright and possibly the hardest working person I have ever met. He was offered a $600,000 advance and a temporary suite in a luxury hotel to come to Dallas and practice neurosurgery. But he couldn't imagine moving to Texas without Jerry.
Well, I was here and he needed help moving to Dallas, and he was closing the labs down here and offered me a job to help him get established in Dallas and to come work in his clinic there, help build a clinic there.
So what kind of work did you do in Dallas? Like examples of the kind of things that you did for him?
Promoting like his clinic and advertising for that and doing all the purchasing for opening up a new clinic.
Did Chris rely on you quite a bit?
Yeah, sometimes.
Chris and Jerry both had romantic developments as they were getting ready to move. Chris had been dating a woman named Wendy Young who got pregnant, so she was moving to Dallas too. And Jerry confessed he had feelings for Jennifer Miller.
When I would tell people that Jerry was moving with Chris, that it made me sad. And I was like, why am I so emotional about Jerry moving? And it surprised me. And then a few weeks after that was when Jerry had told me that he was in love with me. And I just said, wow. And he was like, that's all you have to say is wow. And I was like, yes, I don't know what to say. And so I thought about it for 24 hours. And then I was like, okay, you know, let's date then. We'll try this.
The timing wasn't ideal, but Jerry went with him. They worked together building up Chris's new spinal surgery practice. The hospital hired a marketing guy to help spread his name and to make appointments for Chris to meet other doctors who could refer patients to him for spine surgery. Jerry delivered promotional packets so doctors would know there was a new neurosurgeon in town. In the aftermath of a shocking crime, people always ask why. Who would do something like that? Was it about power, ego, revenge? What makes people like that tick? In Wondery's new podcast, Killer Psyche, former FBI profiler Candace DeLong dissects the thoughts and motivations of the most infamous felons in history. With a career spanning nearly five decades, she sat across the table from hundreds of criminals and spent countless hours inside their minds. In every episode of Killer Psyche, Candace will unravel the psychology and instincts of America's most complex and disturbing figures, including high-profile cases that she personally worked on, like the Unabomber, and other cases, like Christopher Dunch, also known as Dr. Death, where her training and experience can help us understand what was going on inside his head. Was he delusional or a cold-blooded killer? To hear gripping details of the most chilling criminal minds in modern history, follow Killer Psyche on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen to new episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Hey, I'm Mike Corey, the host of Wondery's show, Against the Odds. In our next season, I'm telling an amazing true story about American sailors who wrecked their ship off the coast of Africa in 1815. They're captured by a nomadic tribe. To escape, they will need to cross the largest hot desert in the world to reach civilization. They will battle against blistering heat, inhumane conditions, hunger, and thirst. Their heroic fight to get home will have a much greater impact than just on their own lives. It will influence a future president and change the course of American history in ways that are still felt today. This is the true story of the men who made it, and it's one that you don't want to miss. Subscribe to Against the Odds on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now.
Chris performed only about a half dozen surgeries in his first few months, but he told Jerry he was on his way to building an empire.
He was looking forward to taking over Dallas, or, you know, and doing great things and being really successful.
Jerry was also trying to broker Chris's personal life. He was forgetful, leaving uncapped Sharpies lying around that were ruining the furniture at the hotel. And
Chris, you know, kept wrecking his vehicles, and Jerry would take them and get them, you know, dropped off to the body shops. And Jerry was doing a lot of, you know, cleaning up, you know, Chris's messes. And Jerry was, you know, trying to keep him straight and so he wouldn't lose his job.
In those early months, though, Dunch's employers seemed pleased to have him on board. In September of 2011, he was quoted in the hospital magazine in an article about migraine pain. There was even talk of putting his face on billboards. For all intents and purposes, Dr. Dunch had a gleaming career ahead of him as a neurosurgeon. Jennifer Miller was coming in town to see Jerry every other weekend, and they were talking on the phone regularly. But on one of the calls, Jerry gave Jennifer some surprising news.
It was January, I guess, and Jerry said, "Hey, Chris is going to do surgery on me." And I said, "What? What for what?" And he said, "On my neck."
Jerry told her that Chris was going to fix an old football injury that had gotten worse after a car accident.
I didn't want to throw any negative vibes out there about the surgery, but I remember saying, "Are you sure?" And that was my response. "Are you sure?"
He said that he was.
I said, "Okay, well, you know, let me know when it's scheduled and I'll come and help you."
Jennifer flew in the night before. Jerry picked her up.
When I got in the car, from the airport, and he was like, hey, you can go to dinner. And I said, yeah. And he was like, what do you want? And I was like, I don't know. He's like, I want a steak.
The two went out for dinner. They sat at the bar and watched the University of Memphis basketball team play Southern Mississippi. It was about 9 p.m. before they made it back to Chris's house. Jennifer and Chris stood in the kitchen and talked about Jerry's surgery.
Chris said, hey, do you want to see the MRIs? Do you want to see what I'm going to do tomorrow? And I was like, yeah, I do. And so he went and got the MRI films. And I remember he was holding them up in the kitchen and to light. And he was like, you know, here's the bulge or the herniation and right here. So I'm going to go in and I'm going to fix it right there. And it was a cervical disc. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's pretty neat. Okay, you know, thanks for showing me.
The next morning, Jennifer checked to see if Jerry was up.
And the light was off and it was dark. And then I was like, hey, it's time to get up. And he goes, I'm awake. And I was like, oh my gosh. I remember thinking, did he even get any sleep? And so I drove him to the hospital and he got out and walked in. And I mean, like, you know, we like kissed each other just a peck. And he was like, I love you. I was like, I love you too. And I was like, I'll see you in a couple hours.
Jennifer returned to the house and then gave Chris a ride to the hospital.
I went back home and I just had like an uneasy feeling.
Jennifer and Chris's girlfriend, Wendy, went to lunch together while they waited.
Jerry's mom called me while I was at lunch and she said, hey, where are you? And I was like, I'm at lunch and right down the street. And she said, well, something's wrong. Jerry's in ICU.
When Jerry woke up, he couldn't feel anything from the neck down. He couldn't move. Chris told Jennifer it was from some unexpected bleeding that had lost a lot of blood during the surgery, but that he'd be fine.
Chris ended up taking him back into surgery around midnight. And I remember being back at the house that night, maybe around 10 p.m. And Chris is like, the swelling's not going down in his spinal cord. And I need to alleviate the pressure.
He was right about that. There was pressure on Jerry's spinal cord. During the operation, Dunch had damaged Jerry's blood vessels. To stop the bleeding, he'd packed the space with a substance called gel foam. He used a lot of gel foam. It was constricting Summer's spine. And he'd removed so much bone that Jerry's head wasn't securely attached to his body. Another surgeon came in and did what he could for Jerry, but it was too late to help him. On the phone, Chris told Jerry's mother that he'd had complications, but that he would be okay in about a week.
Chris would come in, and Jerry was very calm with Chris at the time. He was always calm with Chris. He wasn't yelling at Chris or anything like that. And Chris was like, oh, it's just temporary. It's just temporary. The swelling's going to go down. We just need to wait.
Jerry's ICU nurse said later that she felt Chris seemed remarkably unconcerned when he would come into Jerry's room. And he wouldn't tell his friend what was going on. Jerry kept telling his nurse, I know something's wrong. I know something's wrong.
Was it becoming apparent at this point that he wasn't going to get over this?
No, I still believed. I still believed that it was just temporary. It was just temporary. And, you know, I would go to Chris's after the hospital during the day, and I would go there in the evening and have dinner with Wendy and Chris. She would cook dinner, and we'd sit down, and we'd have dinner, and we'd talk about, you know, this or that, or, you know, what. We talked about the surgery, of course, and how, you know, Jerry was going to get better.
He laid in bed for days, at first angry, then depressed. Sometimes he cried. He felt that Chris was keeping him in the dark.
All Jerry would say to me is, I want to die, kill me, I want to die.
If Jerry slept at all, it wasn't much.
And then one day, something snapped inside of him. He started yelling.
He's in there with some nurses, and he said, "That's her. We did 3 8-balls of cocaine the night before surgery and had orgies."
Jennifer called up Chris to talk to him both as Jerry's surgeon and as his friend.
And I was like, "Something's wrong with Jerry."
This incident, Jerry Summers screaming about a cocaine spree with Dunch the night before surgery, would later be widely repeated. But when it came time for Jerry to testify under oath, he said he'd made up the accusations to get Chris's attention. He just wanted answers.
And I guess I had just woken up, and I wanted to see Chris. And so I was really mad and hollering, wanting him to be there. And I made a statement of something to the effect of, "I'll tell someone that you were doing drugs," or something to that effect. And I don't remember exactly what I said, but the statement was only made so that he might hear it and go, "Let me get my ass down there."
Soon after that, Jerry's mother arrived in Dallas. She and Jennifer started not getting along. Then his mother said that Jennifer was not welcome, and she was removed from his visitors list.
At that point, I got banned from the hospital.
Miller returned to Tennessee, heartbroken, confused. Soon after, doctors broke the news to Jerry Summers. He was permanently paralyzed and would likely live out the rest of his life in a nursing home.
Did Chris ever seem upset about the outcome of your surgery?
I never saw that.
Jerry's mother brought him home to Memphis to recover.
Picture this. You're Elizabeth Taylor, all dressed in white, walking down the aisle. You're also just 18 years old, but you're already one of the most famous movie stars in the world. You have a talent for becoming the characters you're playing, and today is no different.
So this is a wedding scene in a movie?
No, this is a real-life wedding, but every detail has been chosen by MGM. The dress, the flowers, the groom.
Wait, what?
Yeah, in the Hollywood studio system, arranged marriages are a fact of life. And today, Elizabeth will either have to say "I do" to her groom or say "I don't" to her career.
Ooh, that's a tough choice. What does she do?
Well, she pulls a move I didn't see coming. But to find out what happens next, you'll have to listen to the newest season of Even the Rich, The Life and Loves of Elizabeth Taylor. Follow on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
Jennifer wanted to see Jerry as soon as he returned to Memphis, but she didn't even know where he was. 5 months went by.
He came back here, but it was a big secret that I wasn't supposed to know where he was and all this kind of stuff. I had tried to, you know, get over it and move on. I think his dad's family had called and said, "Hey, this has gone on long enough. Jerry's not doing well, and we really think that you should, you know, see him."
Opening the door of his room, she was shocked by what she saw. Before the surgery, Jerry had been a big guy.
He was just skin and bones, and he wouldn't eat. And so I went to the hospital to see him, and it was great. I was so happy to see him, and I just remember praying to God, "Please just let me see him again. I just want to take care of him."
With Jennifer's help, Jerry didn't end up living in a nursing home. She took care of him for most of the next year. For a time, he even moved in with Jennifer. But he gradually became consumed by his own rage.
rage over being trapped in a useless body. He turned his power chair into a battering ram.
He gained all his weight back because he started eating again. And he weighed 200-300 pounds, and his wheelchair weighed 200-300 pounds and probably went up to 12 miles an hour. So that force against glass and metal and people. I still have scars on my body from the wheelchair.
It all became too much.
You know, you hurt the ones you love. And he just took it all out on me. You know, his frustrations with everything that's happened in life and the way his life is. And, you know, and people letting him down and, you know, people not showing up. And, you know, he was just so angry.
Today, Jennifer Miller and Jerry Summers don't speak. They inhabit a kind of emotional purgatory, painful to be apart, even more painful to be together.
My girlfriend told me recently that she's been talking to him. And so, you know, I want to talk to him so bad, but I can't. Because there's just so, he's, I don't know.
Jerry doesn't like to talk about Chris. Years later, when the district attorney asked him about his experiences, he seemed to struggle.
What kinds of activities do you miss doing?
Generally everything, because nothing's as much fun anymore.
How do you feel about Chris these days?
I don't know. I don't really.
Is this difficult for you to talk about?
Yeah.
Last February, I visited Jerry at the small apartment in downtown Memphis he shares with a Chihuahua puppy named Stella. He requires 24-hour caregivers, but I happened to catch him alone at dusk between the afternoon and evening shifts. His large body was tipped back in his power chair. Stella stood on his chest, jubilantly wagging her tail as I walked in. "Don't let her fall," he said. The puppy's left front leg was wrapped in a purple cast, broken from a previous plunge onto the wooden floor. He told me he had given his sworn testimony and he didn't have anything more to say. But when I asked a few questions, he responded, and we talked for about 20 minutes. I didn't sense the anger Jennifer had known, just simple resignation. He said he tries not to think about Dallas anymore. He looked out the window. He knew Chris could barely drive a car, and yet he assumed his friend had been better trained for neurosurgery. I asked if Chris had ever visited him in Memphis. Just once, he said, when he was in town about 3 years after the surgery. He showed Jerry pictures of his new baby. "We weren't best friends, like people have said," Jerry told me. As he talked, I scratched Stella behind her ear. She curled up in her bed at his feet and dozed off. I thanked him for letting me in, wished him well, and let myself out. Dunch's friend from Colorado State, Christo Zwa, would learn years later how Dunch's surgical career had so dramatically unraveled. At first, he had a hard time reconciling the Chris he knew with the one who would hurt people, hurt even his closest friend. But then he remembered the linebacker who would never accept the fact that he couldn't do the drill. He just needed to try harder. He just needed to be Rocky.
Do you ever see the movie about the kid that was born with all the gifts and everything came easy to him? That's a boring story. That's not going to inspire anybody. The really bad part is that was someone I used to tell my kids about. I used to tell the story of Chris Dunch working, how he pulled me onto the field, about how he would make me go out at night or early in the morning.
What Dozwa couldn't understand was that Chris Dunch was so obsessed with the person he wanted to be, he couldn't see who he really was. Just like he didn't realize he was a bad linebacker or a bad wrestler, he just didn't realize he was a bad surgeon.
That was my go-to story. And then to find out that in the end, that's where he ended up is tragic. That's not how that story's supposed to end, you know?
There was a lot of the Chris Dunch story that, in fact, Dozwa knew nothing about. All the lies, the drug abuse. Also, there was a damning email Dunch sent to an assistant. The email is long and rambling, but for now, I'll give you the money quote. "I'm ready to become a cold-blooded killer." That's on the next episode of Dr. Death. From Wondery, this is part 2 of 6 of Dr. Death, an investigative miniseries about the system that failed to protect 33 patients in Dallas. If you'd like to help us spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We're available on every major listening app, including the Wondery app. For exclusive episodes of Dr. Death, including an interview with the female voice of Dr. Dunch's misleading infomercial, join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app today. In the episode notes, you'll find some offers from our sponsors. Please support our show by supporting them. Dr. Death was written, reported, and hosted by me, Laura Beale. Sound design by Jeff Schmidt. Story consultant is Jonathan Hirsch. Associate producer is Pallavi Kuthamasu. Executive produced by George Lavender, Marsha Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
I'm John Stamos, and I want to tell you about a new podcast I'm hosting called The Grand Scheme, Snatching Sinatra. Back in 1963, Barry Keenan was broke, alone, and desperate to save his family from personal and financial ruin. In a final Hail Mary attempt to set things right, Barry rolled the dice on an elaborate scheme so bizarre that it's hard to believe it actually happened. He kidnapped Frank Sinatra Jr. This is a complicated story of one imperfect man trying to redeem himself by pulling off the perfect crime. We get a first-hand account of what it's like to see a harebrained scheme like this from start to finish from the guy who concocted the scheme in the first place. And Barry shares every detail, every plot twist, every goofy character he conned along the way. The Grand Scheme premieres on July 27th on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you're listening right now. Or you can binge all the episodes right now when you subscribe to Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.